Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, this is Fran Lewis, and welcome to Book Discussion. This is going to be a really exciting show. We have absolutely one of the best books that I've read in a very, very long time, and the author here, the author of May the Road Rise Up to Meet You, Peter Troy, is here, and we're going to talk about his book. Hi, Peter, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, friend. Thanks for having me on.
I am so glad that you came on. It's a beautiful day up here in upstate New York. I don't know where you are, but the sun finally came out. It was raining all morning, and I'm so glad it came out because every time it rains, they do something to interfere with the train, with the station. So what made you decide to write about this particular time period for this particular book, and can you summarize the book for listeners?
Yeah, well, actually, it's the first book of a trilogy.
Oh.
It began several years ago. I was a high school history teacher. I was a teacher for 15 years in all, and the last 10 in high school. And it sort of was born out of, that interest in history. I taught the Civil War and was always a Civil War buff, shared that with my father as well. And so that was always something that really interested me. And about 6 years ago, I decided, you know what, I always wanted to write. I wrote a lot in college. And I decided I'm going to take the leap and write that book I've been meaning to write all along. You know, I thought I'd take about a year off from teaching to do it and live off of my 401k plan. in a year, I'd have an instant bestseller, and that would be it. And that was how I took the leap. That was in the summer of 2007, actually. So my 401k plan, with the global economic crisis that hit a few weeks after I left my teaching position, that took a bit of a hit. But, so I started out with two characters, really, a modern character, who would come across some of the archives of a character from the Civil War period, who eventually became Ethan McGowan. Mm. And that's the link, and that still is the link between the trilogy. It only now it grew into such a large project that about a year and a half into the process, I realized I don't have one book here. I have three, because I was, well over 1,000 pages probably at that point. So that's when I broke it into the natural divisions that I saw. And this first one takes place from 1847 to about 1867, 20-year span. And it does cover Ethan McGowan, a young Irish boy who survives the hunger, otherwise known as the potato famine in Ireland, comes across as a young boy, 12-year-old, to America to meet up with his father, who's already here. He is one of four primary characters. There's Ethan, there's Micah and Mary, both of whom are slaves in the South, and their stories that follow and their attempt at escaping. And it's a very unusual slave story. I found they're extraordinarily talented in their own right, and so, sort of have a different life mm-hmm. as slaves than maybe the typical story that we've seen of working in the fields and so forth. And then there's Marcella, who her family comes from Spain originally, but she is of the more aristocratic element of society. And she rebels against her family and certainly her father, who's a domineering sort, and she becomes an abolitionist. And so it's their four stories that sort of proceed through that era, through the Civil War, and eventually they do become linked together. And I'll just leave it at that.
We don't want to tell everybody everything. But when you wrote this particular novel in this particular time period, one of the things that I'm noticing that a lot of authors are writing about, each chapter has a different character's name on it. So when you decided to write this, did you plan out each character's position, each character's part in the novel? Did you write their chapters first and then intertwine them? In other words, did you write all of Micah first and then all of Marcella and then Mary and then Ethan? Did you write them separately or did you intertwine them at once?
No, they grew organically. And that was part of the process of learning how to write a story with this many characters and an epic type story. The second time around, I have planned out a lot more and outlined and figured out the backstories of characters and so forth. But the first time, I just jumped right in. And, you know, day one, it was, okay, chapter one, here it is. And I began with it. What happened at that point, once I started to have these characters and they began to interact with people who began as minor characters. For example, Micah and Mary began just as, okay, they're going to be an older couple and, escaped slaves and so forth. And then I started to examine and say, wait a second, how about that? Okay, where did they come from? What about them as younger people, as children and so forth? Mm-hmm. And that's where really the creative process, took over and I filled out these characters' lives. But I was writing the whole time as I was doing that. And what ended up, as a result, after about a 1 year of writing, I had about 600 single-spaced pages of a manuscript.
Wow.
And, yeah, and probably in the final results, I probably ended up scrapping about 90% of that. So it's not necessarily the best way to go about it, just jump in and start writing and then see where the characters are going to take you. I've done a little bit of both, since that time of sort of planning it out and then writing and then getting a feel. And so these characters really developed out of that and their backstories grew as well as I was writing and kind of putting myself into their frame of reference and their mind. I learned a lot more about them.
Well, you know what was really good? I've read a ton of books, everybody knows, close to maybe 1,500 books in 3 years. And I've had other authors that have written books where they, each chapter has a character's name on it, whatever. And sometimes it's really hard to follow because you don't know whether they're writing about the character in the past or you're writing about them in the present. This was really easy to follow. I had no trouble, knowing when you were talking about Micah because you had the dates, the time, and the places at the top of the chapter, which makes it easier for the reader to know what to expect, what time period and when it is, what's happening before, what's happening after. Whereas there are some authors, when they write these, you don't know whether they're in the present, the past, or in another 20 years from now. The part that fascinated me was the boat scene. When Ethan was coming here, they had the hunger and the Irish, and he came here. My grandfather came from Ellis Island, and all I could see were all the crowds of people on the boat and the illness. How much research did you do into that, to finding out just what happens when somebody came here from Ireland or any other country?
I did a good bit, actually. Initially, I'm of Irish descent. Most of my great-grandparents came over later, in time after the famine, but I realized that they had endured that while they were there, their families had. And yet it was something that I really was not terribly well-versed in. We've heard of the Irish potato famine and don't really know exactly what went on. But the population of Ireland decreased by about a quarter over the span of a single decade. About a million deaths and another million that emigrated from the country out of a population of 8 million in total. So it was really incredibly devastating. And as I researched it and read several books on it, and I came to see that, well, for starters, the term the Irish potato famine is really not a true phrase because it wasn't a famine. Ireland, actually, for the first year and a half of the so-called famine, Ireland exported food to England. It was the wealthy landowners who produced, had sharecroppers living on them. Their sharecroppers were forced to mostly live off of what they could plant for themselves, which one of the main crops that they were able to plant for themselves were potatoes. And when the blight hit the potatoes, they were left without the food, but the grains and everything else that they were producing for the landlord, that was still exported. And the English government, which controlled Ireland at the time, did very, very little to do anything about it in the first 2 years of the famine, and that really contributed to the number of deaths as well. So it was just horribly handled and a terrible blemish on history, and it's not something that's really discussed very often. As for the ships themselves coming over, they were the nickname given to them was the coffin ships. They were herded in. It was striking to me some of the similarities, not to the same degree at all, but some of the similarities to the slave ships in terms of how the people were herded in, overcrowded. Usually, they would pack. There were regulations about how many they were allowed to put in per ship, and yet those regulations were never really enforced. So they would systematically pack in 10, 20, 30 extra people into a space, and they would have to lie on their sides practically just to fit in. And there were just flat wooden bunks, and one person after another. So obviously it became a breeding ground for disease. And they were only allotted 16 ounces of food per day, and usually that was pretty rotting, certainly by the end of the trip. So unless you brought food and, were able to somehow get some extra water, there was a lot of near starvation on the voyage as well. So, that's what I write about there on the trip that Ethan makes, the death toll, climbs up into double digits as they cross because of those conditions. And yet that was fairly common at that time.
You could see it. I just want to say one thing. I don't know if anybody's listening out there, but there's a trouble with the chat room for some reason. Every time I go to write in there, they tell me that I'm not logged on right. So I'm sure there are people out there. If I'm not seeing you, I'm really sorry, but there seems to be something, I don't know why there just seems to be a malfunction in the chat room, but at least there's no malfunction on the phone. Which leads me to my next question. He came here and his mother, his Aunt Em, and his mom, and they were quite special. What was the significance of the six books and the plates?
The books, a couple of the books end up being very important through the whole trilogy.
Yeah.
Throw that spoiler out there. But the books are sort of the last vestige of what they're able to take with them. The road that they traveled, Ethan and his aunt and his mother, his sister, was a few years older than Ethan, passed away. She died as a result of the hunger. And the books were shared by Ethan and his sister, and so he carries them with them as his treasures. And the plates are the treasures that his Aunt Emily, they were a set of decorative plates given to her as a wedding present by her husband, who has passed away years before. And that's one of the scenes in there in the early part, I think, in chapter one, where they're traveling to get the ferry over to Liverpool, and the scene of carrying the these books, plates, and these are their last scraps of dignity, really, their last possessions that they're able to take with them for the voyage. And Ethan actually doesn't go with his mother and his aunt. They only have enough money to send Ethan. And so he makes the voyage by himself. His father and brother already emigrated several years earlier to America. And so they're going to, Ethan's going there to be reunited with them. And then the idea is hopefully, they can save enough money to eventually bring over the rest of the family. And that was another very common story amongst the immigrants who came over in the 19th century and the early part of the 20th. The families were very often split before they could be reunited, if at all.
I can recall my grandfather told me he brought my grandmother over, and then he went back and he brought her sisters over, but he had to go through the Underground Railroad in order to get them here. And when he described the conditions on the boat and how lucky, I mean, it was amazing that they even survived. But he met somebody on the boat, right? And there was somebody that befriended him, that sort of protected him. Why was that?
He meets a man, a Sua, an African man, actually, who was an escaped slave himself, had been a slave in the Caribbean, and had run off and now works as a mate on the ships back and forth. And Sua becomes a very important character. He runs into Ethan while Ethan is sort of tucked away in a corner of the ship. reading one of his books, and Sue strikes up a conversation with him, and you know, they become friends, and Ethan actually reads the book with him a little, and Sue watches out for Ethan. So it's, you know, he is that protector, and you know, helps Ethan on sort of make this trip and alleviate some of his fears, and then, you know, when they do arrive, Ethan kind of realizes he's probably saved my life by looking out for me the way that he did.
He wasn't very sure important. About that.
Yeah,
he wasn't
it's
sure
a very
about
important
that.
Relationship, a formative one for him,
yeah,
because he, you know, it informs what Ethan's racial attitudes will be later on. And it really, that kind of goes against a lot of what, you know, the Irish would have felt, the Irish immigrants at that time, since they were along with the African Americans and the free blacks from the South. They were, you know, the two groups really at the bottom rung of the totem pole, so to speak, bottom rung of the ladder. And they very often clashed and fought it out. And but Ethan has different attitudes, and I think that that's really informed from the friendship that he has with Sue on the ship.
Well, I'm going to talk about another character that I found very fascinating, and that was Mary. And tell us about Mary. And I read the first part about her, and who was Gertie?
Yeah, Mary is, I guess you could kind of say orphaned. She's a slave, and her parents were sold off when the plantation owners ran into difficult financial times. And so Mary is left with Gertie, who's a woman who has no children of her own, but has sort of been, has watched out for some of the children, an older woman. And so Gertie becomes sort of the mother figure to Mary. And Mary's sort of the spiritual center of the story. The prologue begins with her and Gertie there.
Yeah.
She is that's the metaphor of the book when Gertie tells her, Gertie is an embroiderer and takes these scraps of thread and whatever she can find and whatever, you know, the big house will let her take and so forth. And she makes these incredible embroideries. She calls them stitchins.
Mm.
And Mary's lying on the ground once watching Gertie, you know, stitching by the fireside. And all Mary can see is the backside of the stitching. And from the back, if you look at the back of an embroidery, all you see is just loose hanging threads, no picture, no image, knots, tangles everywhere. Makes absolutely no sense. And she asks Gertie about that. And Gertie tells her that, you know, she makes a metaphor out of it. She says, that's the way that life is going to be. When you're looking at it from that side, all you're going to see is the struggle, the knots and tangles, everything seeming not to fit together. But then when you turn it around and look at it front ways, then it all makes sense. And that's the metaphor for the book, that all of this struggle, everything they go through, you know, there's meaning to it. And that's really where I began with this story, the idea that there is great meaning to life. And so Mary carries that story forward and repeats it at the end, and she's really the spiritual center of the book.
Lisa, I'm glad I got that right. I read the prologue twice, then I read it again because I wanted to make sure that I got her message with the stitches. That was really clever to start it that way. I just wonder how many people really got it. That was really interesting. Now, Marcella is quite different. I liked her. She's so me. She was really more like, you know, a modern day person. She was more, you know, of this era. She was quite different from the rest, and she decided that she was not going to, you know, deal with her family, and she decided to divorce herself from them. Why? What was it about them that she wouldn't deal with, and how come she was so outspoken? I really like her. She was good.
Yeah, well, Marcella she has a younger sister and then two older brothers. Coming from Spain, a very traditional Spanish family at that point, her father is very domineering, and everything is bestowed upon the two brothers, who, you know, their competency in comparison to Marcella's pales a little bit. And Marcella's, you know, a very, very smart girl, and not self-educated, but pursues her own education. She plays the piano very well, and through that encounters a sort of mentor who, you know, exposes her more to the rest of the world and to you know, to the abolitionist cause and so forth. And it just makes perfect sense for Marcella to see that, you know, that this is what she should be supporting and this is the life she should have. And her father, you know, is actually sort of profiteering off of slave trade. He trades in futures on cotton and so forth, and makes a great deal of money on it. And Marcella really hates that. And so much of what she does is she has to kind of sneak around to do it. She can't boldly and openly defy her father for, you know, while she's still young. But then finally does make the break and decides this is it, I'm leaving, and you know, becomes her own person. And, you know, one of the things about it, because you're not the first person to say she seems like a very modern character.
Yeah.
And there is truth to that in the sense of she's unusual for the age. But
yeah.
She was not alone in that age. You had, you know, in 1848 in upstate New York, the Seneca Falls Conference, which was really one of the first meetings, one of the, you know, a landmark meeting on the women's suffrage movement. And you had, you know, the women suffragettes who were really very active in the abolitionist movement at that time. And then once abolition was accomplished, you know, a lot of the abolitionists sort of went into the suffrage movement as well. So you did have plenty of women at that time who were fighting for these causes and these rights. I mean, we don't hear enough about them, but it certainly was going on.
Like, I could see her walking with a sign. I could feel it.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I could feel that. And the other character that I really like was Micah. I liked him too. I mean, all four characters are so different, yet they're the same in some senses. But Micah worked for this really wonderful slave owner, and then what happens afterwards was really horrible when the man dies and no one wanted to take the plantation or wherever he lived.
Yeah.
So he sent away soap.
Yeah, his father's goal for him is to, you know, work on a separate field, an indigo field that
yeah.
he works on at night. And the money earned from that,
yeah.
he hopes to buy his son's and then his daughter's freedom. And that's an arrangement that's made that doesn't really come to fruition. And that sort of sets Micah's story off. But Micah, again, is another very talented individual. He's an excellent carpenter, craftsman. And what I tried to do with the slave owners is to present a wide range, an array of it. Again, I find too often we get the, you know, Simon Legree character, the sort of stereotype of, you know, just this cruel, practically inhuman person. And that certainly existed. But, you know, you don't have that on a wide scale, wide ranging. You know, that's not the reality that really was there. For many of the slave owners, they looked at him as almost the caretakers. They
really?
Looked at it as their Christian duty to, you know, to look out for their slaves. And so I tried to present that in the life that Mary has, that she lives in the house with them, that she is, you know, her friend Justinia. You know, Mary is really purchased to be Justinia's playmate. She's
playmate,
a couple
yeah.
years older than Justinia. And, you know, and Justinia will tell her, oh, I consider you a sister. You're just like part of the family. You're, you know, and so forth. But really, what was behind it is they were more, you know, like pets almost. You know, they didn't see them as equals, and that's really the thing. So I tried to present that and get to the, you know, the psychological, the variety of psychological elements behind slavery and the slave owners. So you have, you know, the really harsh character and somebody like Dunmore who, you know,
yeah, he was horrible.
Is abusive and so forth. But then you have, you know, the Kittredges and Justinia and, you know, the ones who would treat Mary just like she's part of the family, but they don't get it because they don't really see her that way. They think
no.
that they're being wonderful people about it, but in the end, Mary comes to realize, no, they don't see me as equal. I'm not part of the family, and that's part of Mary's education in that as well.
Yeah,
so I really tried to examine the psychological aspect of slavery, both from slave and the slave owner as well.
Well, you did, because they get both sides. And unfortunately, a lot of times when you see the movies, they depict the Dunmore side, not the other side. They don't show the other side as well. And
yeah.
like you said, no matter how they assimilated, they're really not part of the family. They're just, you know, they're just there. So
yeah.
What major part, let's see, The battle scenes, describe the battle scenes, and why did Ethan decide he was seeing Marcella for a while? I don't want to give away too much about that. So why did he decide that he had to join up? What was his purpose? Why didn't he just stay with her?
Well, he goes, actually, he doesn't meet Marcella till afterwards. His friends are all signing up. And Ethan, one of the things with Ethan is he comes across a group of very close-knit friends that he plays baseball with.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the day comes, shortly after Fort Sumter is fired upon, they actually took the flag from Fort Sumter, the battle, the flag that was raised, the American flag that was raised in the battle, and then lowered when they surrendered. They actually brought it up to New York, and it was displayed in Washington Square. And Ethan is there at this rally of a couple of 100,000 people. And, you know, that's when Abraham Lincoln issued the call for 75,000 volunteers to go and fight. And Ethan and all his friends are immediately answer that, you know, and Ethan would never, he would never let his friends go off and, you know, without him. He's going to sign up. So they sign up for what becomes the 69th Regiment, the fighting 69th of the Irish Brigade. And it was mostly formed of Irish, a lot of them immigrants or maybe second generation, who went and fought and managed to be at just about every major battle in the East Coast, in the, you know, Virginia, Maryland scope of things. And they were extremely brave and saw some really horrific fighting. And I try not to make that too much of the book. I think there's really just a chapter that's, you know, on the battle itself. But
I felt like I was in the middle of the war there. I could tell. I could feel the pain. I could feel the guys dying. You could actually picture it. That's the main thing about this book, that if people read it, you can actually see what the slave owners did. You could see you can feel the lashes that they took. You can hear what their pain, and you can actually visualize it, which is rare when somebody is writing a novel of this type. I often wonder, like, okay, what is that supposed to mean? Or you can't really, if you can close your eyes and see it, then you know that the author's message came through, which it definitely does. And I definitely read this book in less than 2 hours because I couldn't put it down. But historical fiction is rough, but this was really one of the best books I've read in a very long time. And I said I had no problem, you know, following along and following the plot. At least I hope I didn't. But how does Micah meet Mary? How do they, you know, because after a while, everybody sort of intertwines.
Yeah, well, you have the two love stories, Micah and Mary and Ethan and Marcella. And Micah and Mary, Micah eventually ends up in Richmond where Mary is, and he's hired out to do a carpentry job at near the shop where Mary works, and he sort of sees her one day, and you know they sort of exchange glances, and then it's not till later on that they actually get a chance to really talk and get to know each other. So it's sort of a serendipitous moment for both of them, but especially for Micah, who's had it really rough up to that point. But if I could just mention something about what you were talking about before with, you know, feeling the scenes, what I tried to do is every now and then, and especially at crucial moments like the battlefield scene, let's say, I try to slip into second-person narrative. And I try to do it subtly so it's not, you know, it doesn't kind of scare you off to have, you know, suddenly the reader, you are the character, you are Ethan, you are Micah, you are Mary and Marcella.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I tried to do, because I think if you can kind of slip into that and not really notice that there's a change, but there it is, in this scene, you are that character, I think that helps in connecting the reader to the character every now and again. You know, it's primarily told in third person, but every now and again to slide into that second so that you can actually try to be in their skin. You know, what I came across in doing this, and it's a difficult thing to try to, you know, here I am a, you know, white Irish male, you know, and here I'm trying to write about African-American characters, about female characters and so forth. To do that, I really had to try to find a portal of discovery into each of them. And I had to find, you know, what's that one thing that I say I can relate to? I have this in common with them, maybe not in their circumstance, but in terms of their character or in terms of their personality. And when I was able to find that it sort of opened the door up to understanding more and more and more. And as I kept examining and going through that, now what would it be like if I was placed in that situation and imagining that, I think that was where I was able to really connect with these characters. You know, I felt like they sort of followed me around for about 2 years, and I got to know them pretty well.
I'm having trouble with my screen. This is not good. For some reason or another, I'm trying to get back to the screen that I was on before, and for some reason I'm not getting it. This is not good. The flesh chat room. I'm not going to worry about it. Oh, here I am. Okay. For some reason I lost the main screen. Oh, here I am. I got it back. The chat room seems to be not working the right way. I'm not going to worry about it. Okay. The other question is, the timeline of events is quite tight during this time period. How are you able to keep the plot flowing in such a way that, you know, you're going from the beginning of it, 1843, all the way to the end? And how are you able to just connect all the parts between the beginning, the Irish Hunger, then to the Civil War, and then toward the end?
Yeah, well, a lot of that comes in the editing process. Yeah. I think when you write, you tend to tie everything together and almost put in every event, every scene that you see of it that is, you know, of any importance at all. And then when you come to the editing, you have to look at it and say, okay, is this really vital? You know, is this really important to the story or to the development of the character? And, you know, a lot of times I think you can remove more than you think. And a lot of times when you do that, it just strengthens the rest of it. And that's what I found in the editing process, my own personal editing process that I went through.
Well, many drafts did you do? Because 690 some odd pages would have been 690 pages too long. You're right.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. That was the first time through that got divided into a trilogy. And you know, so that was really when it was all one story that spanned 150 years. You know, once I divided it into a trilogy, which was about, you know, a year and a half in, then I completed a draft 6 months after that of the first book. Mm-hmm. So really it was 2 years from the very start that I had a draft of what became May the Road Rise Up to Meet You. And at that point, the draft was about 240,000 words. The current form is about 150. So I really had to cut a lot out and I thought at first, this is going to be really difficult. And it really wasn't. You know, I had added a lot more in about the Civil War being a history teacher. You know, I wanted to have every battle in there and so forth. And so I was able to, you know, look at that and see the big picture and say, this is not, they don't have to be at every spot and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so I was really able to cut that down. And that was at the time when I had the idea of giving each character their own style of prose, their own voice. And so that was the final rewrite that I did. I did that first draft, then I edited that down and kind of sewed it back together so there weren't really any visible seams in it. And then I had this idea of, you know, giving each of them their own voice and their own style of prose. So Ethan, you kind of, even in the prose, not just in the dialogue, you have a bit of the Irish brogue. And with Mary, you have, you know, all different levels of communication because Mary has to be this sort of chameleon depending on the company that she's in. Everything from speaking refined French to, you know, almost a field hand drawl. And Micah, this very quiet, very reserved, you know, very sparse language. He doesn't use 5 words when 3 words will do and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I gave each character their own voice in that final draft. And then that was the last go through. And that was when I really felt like it was done.
Well, you helped me refresh my French lessons, too, because I took French, and I got the French medal in junior high school. And I'm going like, okay, I can still remember that. This is really good. It added to it. And the French lessons, I got a kick out of it, because slaves were not allowed to learn to read, and they weren't allowed to write. And the fact that she was able to, and they helped, and they taught her, the family that she was with, really, you know, helped forge her ahead. And then she went to work in their store. And that was even more amazing. So I'm saying, well, you know, there are some families that treat you sort of not as family, but almost like a human being. And she was lucky for that response.
Yeah, but there's a little bit of, a little subterfuge going on there for Mary. And again, this is part of the assumption. It's not that they're teaching Mary to do these things. It's that Mary is stealing the lessons.
Yeah.
And Justinia has her own private tutor. You know, she's a wealthy family, so she has a tutor that comes and teaches her English and math and French and so forth. And Mary's allowed, because she's Justinia's playmate, she's allowed to be in the room with her. And nobody figures that Mary's actually paying attention. They
give
her some
absorbing all of this,
Yeah, and she's soaking it all up, and so she kind of steals her education in that manner.
That's amazing. I wonder how many more actually did that. I have a very strange question, because I don't want to give away too much more of the plot. But for those of you out there that haven't read May the Road Rise Up to Meet You, I don't know what you're waiting for, because you really, need to get up and read it. Slavery is an issue, and as an educator, how many students in high school or in school actually understand or know this time period? And have you ever used this? Would you ever use your book as a discussion to use it as a discussion in a high school class? Would you use it to start a discussion in a high school class of students that would be studying this particular time period?
Yeah, it has been used, not in history classes so far, but in a couple of English classes. In Roslyn High School, they actually added it to part of the curriculum. A former colleague of mine, Joe Capozzi, he had it, and I got a chance to go in and speak to his students this year in May, and that was really a wonderful experience. And so they use it as part of their comparative literature course. And at my old school that I taught at Kellenberg Memorial High School on Long Island, they did it for summer reading. Notre Dame High School did it for their summer reading as well. It's being used kind of with English, because I guess it does give you that perspective of first, second, third person narrative and so forth. But I think there's a lot from the history standpoint as well. Like I said, the Irish famine is something that is not really discussed much at all. And certainly slavery, and, it's unfortunate, but it has been presented too often in a stereotypical fashion, where you don't have characters like Micah and Mary. You know, there a character like Frederick Douglass was real. Harriet Tubman was real.
Yeah.
And they were both born slaves. How did they become so well educated? How did they become the dynamic figures they were? That existed. Those people existed amongst the slaves. And that's what I tried to write with Mary and Micah. I don't give them unrealistic characteristics.
No, you didn't. No.
Intelligent, and that they go about their business in the way that they do. But it's really that their talents are stifled by the institution of slavery. And so I wanted to examine that aspect of it as well. We don't really teach it that way. And unfortunately, you get something like Django Unchained, which becomes part of the modern folklore, and that's supposed to be our image of what slavery was, and that's so far from the reality. It's sad that there's not really anything that's a more accurate representation of it. And so hopefully someday we do see this in some history classes. I'd love the opportunity to speak to them, certainly.
I agree, because as an educator and working with kids in reading and writing, and I'm reading the classics and books like that, and having history professors, there were so many of them that just said, read the textbook and regurgitated what was in it. And basically, if anybody ever bothered to read the textbook, you have to know that by the time the textbook gets printed and sent to the classroom, there's history it's old. And you need to find out what's new. And half of the textbooks even when I taught sixth grade and was teaching, history, I would say, oh, my goodness, the copyright was 1975 and it was 1990. I mean, you can't teach history from outdated materials, and that's probably why we're lucky to have the internet in that. But I'm wondering, you said comparative literature, which, of course, is something I love, dealing with literature and English. Did the students that you work with, did they ever try to rewrite a narrative, a first or second place narrative, as if they were Micah or Marcella or Mary or Ethan? Did they ever try to write their own version?
Not that I'm aware of, not in the high school classes that read it, but Also, we had the book featured in the Tale for Three Counties in Western New York, mm-hmm. and so one of the local community colleges was reading it there, and they had a contest on, writing an essay on who your favorite character was and why, and what you know mm-hmm. what you connected and saw in them, and so forth. So, so that was a wonderful experience, and. Great to see them. So these were students on the community college level reading it. It would be an interesting exercise for them to take it and to take one of the characters and maybe make them a modern figure or so forth. It would be interesting to see where that would go.
That's the reading teacher in me. That would be something that I would definitely do if I was teaching a writing class or a reading class like that. Try to bring it in. I would wonder how Marcella would do with Women's Lib, to be very honest, because she would probably fit, in perfectly with what's going on today, too. She probably would make a great state senator. You just don't know. That's just a reading in me. So if each of these characters could define the word freedom, how would they define it? What would they say, when the slaves finally got free? How would they define the word freedom? What would their definitions be if they could define it for themselves?
I think it's actually an important link to all four of them.
Yeah.
And, we think in terms of Micah and Mary as the slaves, it might be a literal definition of freedom, to be freed from slavery. But I tried to put this in, and really this is the link between the four characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much just the literal aspect of freedom, being able to go where you choose and so forth.
Yeah.
But it's really what all four of them face, which is the element of not being fully free to be the people that they are, to make the most of their talents and to explore what their talents are and where it can take them. All four of them are stifled in some way. Micah and Mary, obviously, as slaves, as you mentioned before, it was against the law mm-hmm. for them to know how to read. So even just to get that level of education, they were in danger. That certainly stifled them and their talents. And yet they still found a way to become really, quite proficient at what they did
mm-hmm.
and quite special in their own way. Marcella was stifled by being a woman. And she brings that up and mentions that many times, were mm. she a man, her opportunities would have been significantly different. And Ethan as well, being born poor. And in Ireland, being born to the poor, sharecropping, working class. And, that absolutely stifles your opportunities. And there were even government policies in place to hold that class down. His opportunities are expanded when he comes to America. But even then, he still faces the prejudice that, that a lot of immigrants at that time did. And I tried to put that in the scene where he goes to see a professor at New York University, and he
mm-hmm.
wants to study there. The professor, mocks him and essentially says, this is not the place for you. And even though Ethan is a very intelligent and very well-read. Each of the characters, I guess, how they would define freedom is sort of what we describe today in America, the opportunity to rise to the level of your talents and your work ethic. How far will those, will your diligence and your ability take you? And for all four of them, that's really what they have to fight for.
I sat there when I read that scene from the college, and I was getting angry. And I'm saying, how can he, you're looking at him as what he's just looking at him, not as a person, but as somebody that he wasn't schooled, he didn't have this, he doesn't have that. And you could see the time period is like, oh, I'm not going to give you a chance. And it didn't matter whether he was black or white or anything. It's just that the man just said, the stereotype was there. That is the sad part about it. Now, if you could add another chapter to the book or another character, would you have added one more character, or would you change anything about the way you wrote this book?
In the final product, no. I think I said what I wanted to say, for these characters. They mm-hmm. do appear in the second book, which I'm actually finishing up now.
Cool.
I'm a few weeks away from having a draft of the second book, which is called The Plowshare Legacy. And they, you know, you'll see all four of them make, you know, cameos, so to speak, in the beginning of this and sort of pass the torch on to subsequent generations. But I really, in the end, I probably had written more. It wasn't that I wrote less and didn't have enough and would like to add something to it. I think I had all of that in it. Really wrote a vast work and then had to sort of pare it down. I don't think I would change anything in that regard. I wouldn't add another character in that. It's really about these four, and they fit together, and they fit that puzzle nicely. It would be interesting to explore some of the smaller characters, Ethan's brother, for example, who works in Tammany Hall and is connected there in the Five Points slum and so forth. Be interesting to explore him, and maybe who knows, maybe I will someday. But
that was my hint. Yeah. he was interesting, and you know what? Also, I said, "Oh my God!" When he met President Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln is like my favorite president in the whole ever. And if I could meet one president, it would be him.
Yeah, me too.
Yes, self-taught, brilliant.
That scene where he meets him. Yeah, where he goes to see him speak in 1860 at Cooper Union, and then meets him at the hotel afterwards. That actually happened. Lincoln did speak, and he walked back to his hotel alone, and that was common at that time. He was an unknown figure, really, in the East. You know, just the, and he, that's where he kind of burst onto national prominence with that speech that he gave. So, you know, I kept that in there to have Lincoln because he becomes, you know, important in the subsequent plot of things, but that's really the only cameo I sort of threw of a famous person in there in the first book.
It would that really like hit me. I said, "Oh my God, that is so very very interesting." That was really I love President Lincoln. What can I say? If Mary could speak, if she could speak, what would she say was the main turning point of her life? What would she say was the most important thing that she would hope readers would get from hearing her story in this book?
That's an interesting question. Now I think I know what it would be. I think it's the moment at the fall of Richmond. I don't want to give anything away.
No, I don't want to give it away.
But it's a moment where she kind of comes into her own at the end of the war, and you know, the fullness of her understanding of herself and of, you know, everything that's around her and where she's headed and so forth. And I think it would be at that moment that, you know, that's the turning point for her.
Now, when you said that you're going to only bring them in as cameos in the next book, you're not going to you're just going to show where they turn, where they are, and what happened to them at this point.
Well, no, they all in one point have speaking parts, I guess you could say, you know. And I don't want to give away too much, but
no.
Micah plays the most prominent role of the four of them, and you know, it is called the Plowshare Legacy, so it takes off on that, but. You know, they are there in, you know, one segment of the book. They're, you know, very much present and important. And
yeah,
as I say, I think, you know, an appropriate amount to kind of hand it off to the next generations of characters. It's picks up with Ethan and Marcella's grandson. And, you know, he's the son of Aislinn, their daughter. And then their great-granddaughter, who's Grace, is a very interesting character. She's born in 1926, so she comes of age during World War II and so forth. So those are really the two lead characters, along with another one, a friend of the family. So
you're going to bring in World War One and World War One. You brought in the other one. World War II, you're going to bring in this one.
Yeah, World War One and World War Two, the Depression. It spans 50 years, but it's
I'm getting static. I'm getting static. Hello? I'm getting static. I can't hear you.
Oh,
now I
can. I'm still here.
I can hear you.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm getting static. It happens sometimes. So, what is the time span of this of the second book? Because I couldn't hear what you said.
The second one will run from about 1907. to 1950 or 49. So a little over 40 years it covers, and it's again, you know, Ethan and Marcella's grandson and their great granddaughter, sort of the family line that it follows, and the legacy of Mary and Micah are very important in it as well. And so you do get moments of not so much the First World War, but certainly the Second World War is there, the Depression a little bit, and, you know, there's a few scenes set in New York in the 1940s, New York City, and so forth. So,
you're going to bring in Roosevelt? You're going to bring in FDR?
Well, no, he's not. He doesn't make a cameo appearance, but they do.
Okay, good.
You know, on the radio, you know, but that's about it.
Oh, okay.
Jackie Robinson makes an appearance.
Are you going to bring in the telephone? You're going to bring in the telephone too, and a little technology.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see the advancement of technology during the course of this story alone. Because so much really technology really exploded in the first half of the 20th century. So, you know, you do see the difference there with them. They start out, you know, horse and carriage riding to the train station, and then end up on the subway, you know, and riding their cars and so forth. So try to get a little sprinkle of all of that in there. The history teacher in me still, you know, wants to, you know, show the background of what life was like. So,
well, you're
going to
do also, what about journalism, too? Are you going to, the evolution of, you know, the different types of newspapers and stuff and how news was reported, are you going to do anything with that? Because even back then it was different.
Yeah, there's a scene or two of, you know, radio broadcasts, Pearl Harbor, you know, key moments. Sometimes most people were getting their news either in print or you know, on the radio was very big. So I do have one scene in there where the bombing of Pearl Harbor, actually they hear it in the middle of a football game. It's, you know, they interrupt their football broadcast and bring the news of what has happened. So, yeah, I do have that in there.
This is going to be interesting. And how long do you think before I get a copy of this book?
Well, I hope to have it drafted in a few weeks. I've been at it for a while. It's been kind of up and down, trying to promote the first book and so forth. But I'm hoping to, you know, in the next couple of months, finish my rewrites and send it off to my agent and editor and see where we go from there. And then it's right into work on the third. As I said, I really kind of developed the characters and the storyline in that first year and a half while I was writing all of it as one project. But I got better as a writer in that time, so I have to go back and pretty much rewrite everything I wrote in that first year. But, yeah, so I'll be right into that. Hopefully in the next, you know, year or two it'll be out and published, and then it'll be on to the third. The third one actually is set, it's the shortest time span of the three. It's set from about 1998 to about 2006. The biggest historical moment is 9/11. And there's, you know, a couple of scenes set around that and the characters that are there when the towers come down and so forth. So, you know, that'll be, and that's you know, very close to my experience. I taught about 40 minutes away from the towers and the school I was teaching in at the time. So that'll be tough to write, but also trying to focus on some of the beauty that we saw and the way that people reacted to it and how they handled themselves and the camaraderie and everything that was formed coming out of that. So that's going to be more the focus on how I present that.
That was a really difficult time. I lost a student in 9/11, one of my fifth and sixth grade students, and it was funny because she came to bring her cousin to school. Hold on a second. One second. I think my husband has locked himself out. Hold on a minute. I let him back in. the catch on the door sometimes just closes, and he locked himself out. Okay. Question. If all four characters lived in this time period, where would you see them?
Interesting. I think Ethan would be a teacher.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Micah might be an engineer, an architect, perhaps. Yeah, I could see Mary and or Marcella in politics. Certainly.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah, and I think Mary would be an artist.
I would wonder what high school kids or college kids would actually think if you wrote this story in modern day with different characters. Would you ever think to take, even in the last book or whatever, that all the characters in the last book, I take it, are going to be different, correct? They're not going to be Ethan, and then by then they'll be too old. Would you ever write a murder mystery or anything where you actually killed off a main character?
Yeah, that could be. I don't know. I've had this story in my head for the last few years, so I really am just focused on finishing, you know, these next two books and completing that story. And then on from there, I'd like to, I don't know that I'll stay in the historical fiction realm or something different. So that's certainly a possibility.
I told you, this is the reading teacher in me. Yeah, it's funny because when you ask questions of an author, everybody asks, okay, how come you became an author? When did you just start to write? And to me, those are just like anybody could ask those particular questions because you can read that in somebody's bio or whatever like that. It's just different. Which one of the four characters was your favorite? I would imagine Ethan is more like you, correct? He would be more you? The historian.
Yeah, in some ways, probably. He was probably the easiest for me to write, to connect to. I kind of, in some ways, Micah, I think, you know, too, as well. You know, when he has that sort of spiritual crisis when he goes to the top of the mountain and, you know, that's definitely, been, you know, a philosopher myself for a while. So I have some of that in me. So, yeah, either one of those two. There's a little bit of four, I'd say, actually.
So before we close and whatever, let me ask, where can everyone get your book and learn more about you?
Well, it's available certainly online, Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. The paperback, I think, should still be in Barnes & Noble. They can check out my website, MayTheRoadRiseUpToMeetYou.com. And, you know, I have some background information and the story behind the book and the process and so forth. And they can contact me through that.
Actually, I was lucky because I found the book and I said, okay, Anchor Publishing published it. When I emailed them, they told me I had the wrong group. And I found your website. That's how I was lucky to get to you directly, because for some reason Anchor Publishing said I had the wrong anchor or whatever, and I couldn't get the right, I'm persistent when I want to read a book, what can I tell you? And then it said Doubleday on here, and for some reason on the thing it said something else, so I was glad that I got this, and I was really glad that my cousin was reading this in her book club. They thought it was probably one of the best books. They hold their book club in a library. And there's a ton of them, about 40 women, and they said they couldn't put this down. They were raving about it. They said it's one of the best books they've ever read. So that leaves me with, this is my top pick for the month, everybody. By the way, your review is in my new magazine, MJ Magazine, and the review is in there, and it's probably going to be in the second edition also, which I hope comes out in November. It's a magazine in memory of my sister. The other three picks are Schreiber's Secret by Roger Radford. Is a really good book about the Holocaust. It's excellent. And yesterday I read a book, And the Rain Came Down by S.A. Bailey. It's absolutely really interesting book about a young man that comes back from the war and who has post-traumatic syndrome, and he's got a whole bunch of other problems just dealing with life in general. And I read two children's books yesterday, The Princess and the Ruby, an autism fairy tale, and Cinderella's Magic Wheelchair by Julia Katz. And The Princess and the Ruby is going to be featured in the next edition of the magazine because we're going to do a whole big thing on autism. So this magazine is for everyone, and anyone that wants to submit a story or an article for the third edition, please email me at riffy1@optonline.net, and I'll be more than happy to see if your article fits in paper. If you have an article on current events or a book review or anything like that. And Peter, if you want to put anything in the third edition or the second edition, just let me know. We were writing tips, editing tips, the fact that you have so many drafts and stuff. I think authors really need to know that, because a lot of times, people will send in something and they don't realize, for example, when your editor edited your book, does he change the story or give you changes in the storyline, or do you decide that?
She made suggestions. They were really mostly minor in terms of the storyline itself.
Uh-huh.
They're not going to make very bold, sweeping changes to it. But really, most of it is, as I learned, really things you need to do in advance. You don't want it to wait to the submission, because I think it's so selective now. You really have to have something that's very refined before you send it out to agents or editors.
You are 100%
there are,
right.
Multiple drafts involved,
And grammar errors. I mean, I read, I won't say who, a few unedited manuscripts, because I get them before they come out, because they want my opinion, they want me to review it, they want me to tell them what I think they could fix. And I read one last week, and I emailed the publicist, and I said, you sent me two copies of the book, and you sent me the final one, and the final one had the same errors as the unedited one. Somebody didn't do it right. And at times, you didn't have it in your book, which is great. There are character mistakes where the gender of a character is wrong in a sentence, or the character they mention, they say blah blah is so and so's sister or brother, and they say the wrong thing. So you're right. Having an editorial review and having somebody go through it is important. But those grammar, those typos, and those grammar mistakes and spelling errors can sometimes, the choice between a 5-star review and a 3-star review and ruining the flow of the story. If it doesn't, kill the sentence or it doesn't hurt the story, I mean, if it's just like the and the E's left out, big deal. But when it changes the storyline or it, hurts what you're trying to say, then that makes it hard. And you didn't have any grammar errors or anything. That your book was great. But I want to thank you so very much. And I do hope you keep me in mind. I want the next one.
Oh, absolutely. I'll make sure you get a copy.
I definitely want the next one. You can send it even before it comes out, because I can plug it on my site, reviewing your book. I have my own review site on Facebook. And we have 237 people that belong to the site. They're all reviewers, by the way, besides me. And I'm going to repost the review right now so that everybody could read it, and I'm going to repost the link in case anybody didn't hear the show. But I definitely I thank you so much, and I definitely want to read the next one, because now I have to know what happens next to them. Somehow I knew there was more.
it's an interesting story, so I'll get back to finishing it up then. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you so much, Peter. I appreciate it, and thank you, everyone. I'll be back on September 18th with my new show on Red River, Chat Time with Fran and John Land. And we're going to talk about his new book, Strong Rain Falling. The next day on The World of Ink, Alan Topol's new book is coming out September 10th. The Russian Endgame, it's interesting, and we're going to talk about that. The week after, I am totally excited, Mark Rubenstein, Love Gone Mad. And Iris Johansson will be my guest. We're going to talk about Silencing Eve, and let's find out if they do. So for all those listeners out there, thank you very much, and I hope you have a pleasant afternoon. Thank you, and good night.